Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and that's Teddy Pendergrass. Joy. He was born on this day in 1950, and what a loss to our world, Teddy Pendergrass, and his lovely voice. So as we get into this program today, I want to remind you that the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by the Maryland State Education Association. From funding to school funding to Common Core, you can learn about the important issues affecting Maryland students, parents, and schools by visiting the Maryland State Education Association's website at MarylandEducators.org. That's one word, MarylandEducators.org, or go to SteinerShow.org and click on the Maryland State Education Association banner, which is on our website. We are about to take up an issue here that, again, was brought to our attention, but this time by Imara Jones's most recent piece, In Color Lines, The Economic Truth About the Model Minority. This country, as it changes demographically, is dealing with all kinds of mythology and realities and struggles around race. Our history of race and racism in America still affects many ways in which we look at the world we live in at the moment. And so we are joined now by Imara Jones once again, who's the economic justice contributor for ColorLines.com. He served in the Clinton White House, where he worked on international trade policy. His article, which appeared yesterday in ColorLines, as I said, is titled The Economic Truth About the Model Minority, which is how Asian Americans are seen in America by our press, by the world. We are going to kind of wrestle with that, try to do some things to explode that myth and talk about the realities of race and culture in our culture. We're also joined by Sina Huang Jensen, who is a member of the Baltimore Racial Justice Action, a project of Fusion Partnerships. She's a graduate student at the University of Maryland College Park studying Asian American history and a member of the Moonroot Collective. And Sui Park is a writer and activist from Chicago, creator of this viral piece, Not Your Asian Sidekick, a hashtag on Twitter, and has written some really remarkable pieces that we'll be linking to on our website. And Sui, Sina, Imara, welcome. Good to have the three of you with us.
Morning.
Thanks.
Good morning. And you all can join us out there, 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Log on to our Facebook pages. You can also tweet us here at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. So, Imara, let's talk a bit about the piece you wrote and why. When this came across, we started looking at the other pieces that Julianne Hing wrote for Color Lines and then the op-ed that came out from Ellen Wu at the L.A. Times earlier this year. So, but talk about what instigated this article that you put out the other day.
What instigated it is a report that came out this earlier this month, put out by the Center for American Progress, which examined the economic reality across the major ethnic groups that we, according to the census, label as Asian Americans. There are, in their study, included 14 different subgroups. And what it revealed was that there is a tremendous amount of varied states of economic well-being amongst these varied groups. And despite the fact that on average, Asian incomes, Asian American and Pacific Islander incomes exceed those of every other group in this country, that's basically true for only 3 out of the 14 subgroups, and that many of the others have poverty rates that are double digits, that exceed the white poverty rate by 50%, and that underscore the fact that unless you're a member of what is numerically a minority of these of the Asian groups that are doing well, then you're really not doing well. And so, it basically groups up into two groups. And so if you're from the larger, more prosperous countries that have a history of cultural and economic ties to the United States, such as India or China or Japan or the Philippines, those groups do extremely well in the United States. But pretty much all of the rest begin to slide down to scale, and many are in economic distress, such as people from Southeast Asia, Cambodia, Vietnam, there's just a tremendous amount of variety. And we created this idea of the model minority, where it was created as a way to serve greater purposes around trying to dismiss race as an institutional problem and to transform it into a cultural problem by saying, well, why, you know, aren't African Americans or Latinos doing as well as Chinese Americans or Asians in general under this model minority rubric? But it only works if you slice it and dice it to be so specific that it loses any meaning.
And Sina Huang Jensen, I mean, one of the things that I think we have a tendency to do in this country is to make everything into a monolith. I was going to say monolithize. I don't know if there's such a word. But, you know, I mean, as Asian American, or we say Arab American, or we say Latino Americans. And it's this broad brush we give that doesn't take into account of who we really are.
Absolutely. I think that's a really good point. And I really have to agree with what Amara has been saying. The Asian American and Pacific Islander racial group, you know, brings together a diverse range of nationalities, ethnicities. And so, as Amara's article points out, there's a lot of variety when you look at the statistics. There's also something that people tend to ignore is the role of selective immigration in shaping the communities of Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders. So when you look particularly, you know, historically at different nationalities, at different points in time, you see different waves of migration. So in the 1950s and 60s, during the Cold War, there was a really big push to recruit Asians to the United States who were in the STEM fields. So you see, for example, in the Chinese American community, between 1940 and 1970, Chinese Americans in technical fields increases from 2% to 27%. So that's just one example of how selective immigration can shape our community.
And you're saying it's being shaped by that selective immigration?
That's one aspect. There's many other different aspects. But one thing that the model minority narrative serves to do is it invisibilizes the Asian American experience both economically and historically. Facts like this, you know, get pushed under the rug and it all gets painted, as you said, with a very broad brush.
Right, exactly. And Sui Park, it's great to have you with us as well. I do enjoy the stuff you put out there a lot. I'm glad you're on our program with us. And one of the things I was thinking about, just taking this off, how we extend this out, you know, there's a university here in Maryland, the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. That's one of our premier universities growing in America and its reputation and does a lot to kind of help communities of color come in and get success in the STEM fields, but in our own kind of racist thinking, people often call this university SUI as a kind of a slur. They say UMBC stands for you must be Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's part of this kind of love-hate relationship that much of our community has, much of America has, not a lot, all of America, much of America has around Asian people, and specifically people who are Chinese.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of fear that happens when people too deeply internalize the model minority myth. I think a lot of that comes with resentment. Like I saw at my university, there was at one point these memes floating around the internet, which sparked a lot of my initial digital activism. And they all said, like, am I on the University of Illinois quad or am I in Chinatown? And we had like
right.
less than 10% Asian Americans, but it's seen as like this overabundance, like we are seen as perpetual foreigners. And I think a lot of people start believing that, like, we haven't earned our spots at universities because of this logic, that we just are naturally smarter, that we have more money, more resources. When that's definitely not true, like, the Asian American survey that just came out in 2012 shows that over 60% of Asian Americans are worried about college affordability. And so I think it's really good that we kind of unpack the model minority myth predominant society.
And folks, your thoughts, 410-319-8888. We have a lot of issues to raise and wrestle with here. Apache in Baltimore, you're on the air.
How are you doing?
Very well. Welcome.
Yeah, I want to sit down and before anything else, and Freeman Rabowski has done a beautiful thing for UMBC.
He has, no question.
The only thing we remember him for is, guess what, UMBC going to what? Playing the NCAA. You don't know how many chess championships they have won, right? Remember?
I'm not quite sure what I'm not quite sure what you're saying, Apache.
No, chess championships.
Yes,
collegiates.
Right, right.
That's a student athlete. College.
Okay.
UMBC became nationally known, not because of what he's doing, but for the team, the basketball team.
All right, did you have another comment? We're not talking about UMBC. I just used that as an aside. So
you have waves of people coming into the country. So we had the Germans, we had the Irish. And you had people from West Indies. But that's a wave. America is always about a wave. It's not about a boarding port. It's about a salad bowl. And that's the most important thing. That I could sit down and find a beautiful place. Instead of them, someone going to University of Maryland, they would rather go to UMBC because there is culture, and not only culture, but there is what? Beautiful.
Okay. Apache, I appreciate the call. And I want to kind of talk about this arc that happens in this country. And I was thinking about the idea in America, in the Asian community, and where we were, where we've come to, and how these things meet. There's a comment people make all the time. You've heard it growing up. People say a Chinaman's chance, which means you have zero prospects of making it. In this country, from like the 1870s to World War II, there was vast discrimination against Chinese immigration and against Asian people in general, and that kind of, to me, is all wrapped up in some ways, Sina, with the notion of the model minority.
It absolutely is, and I think with any kind of racial common sense, which I kind of think is what the model minority is, it becomes common sense. It's really important to look at the specific historical context from which it emerges. As you said, between 1870 and World War II, Asian immigrants were essentially banned from coming to the United States. And it's not until 1952 that Asian immigrants were allowed to become citizens of the United States. So I think when you look at the history, there are four really important contexts that we need to keep in mind. The first is that in the 1950s and 60s, the U.S. is engaged in the Cold War. So it had an investment in promoting itself as a beacon of racial tolerance in the face of Soviet charges, of racism. In addition, it was invested in justifying military interventions in Asia specifically. So in that context, it became an imperative to shift American mainstream perceptions of Asians in America, and that resulted in some of the legal transformations that I mentioned in 52 and 65. And the second historical context is that you see the rise of black militancy and black power movement in the 1960s. And so this meant that the stereotype could not only function to promote the U.S. abroad, but it could also demonize other communities of color, including particularly African Americans. And because of the way that it uses cultural explanations rather than structural explanations, it focuses on the pathologization of communities of color, looking for where culturally they are failing to succeed. And the third is that at this time, you also see social scientists and the media promoting this concept and enshrining it in academic knowledge. So social scientists are producing studies that are skewing the data, answering the question, why have Asian Americans succeeded? That's their starting question. So they're creating this as a racial common sense. And then the fourth context that's really important is looking internally at Asian American communities as well. The 1950s and 60s, this is in the wake of Japanese internment, the intense political repression of the Chinese American community in the 1950s. And so there was also an investment among some community members within the community to promote this image as a way to establish security against intense anti-Asian racism. And this is what Ellen Wu's book, The Color of Success, that's mentioned in Amara's article, also references. So I think it's really important to keep in mind this historical context because it reveals the political purposes that the stereotype serves, not only to demonize other communities of color, but to depoliticize and invisibilize the Asian American experience.
Because I think part of it's wrapped up, and I was thinking about this, and Amara and Sui, just in thinking about what Sina was just saying, that the whole notion of asking why do Asians succeed is a problematic question to start with. And how do we respond to that question? What does that question say about the kind of changing demographic of America and our wrestling with race in America? I think that, in some ways, goes to the kind of the bottom line of all this, Imara.
Yeah, you know, I think the bottom line is a really, really important place to start, because the way in which we, this country, engages Asian Americans changes based upon our economic need. And so, for instance, when we were building the Transcontinental Railroad in the 1860s and 1870s and 1880s, there was active recruitment of people from China to immigrate to help build that road, because ironically, a lot of the expertise they had in explosives and demolition was really important to building out the Western United States. But after those railroads were complete and they were no longer needed, there was a whole scale rounding up and deportation of that entire community back to China. And, you know, one of the things that you were just touching upon is that, and just as was said before, that's continued depending on, you know, what our technological needs are and all of the rest of it. The other thing, though, is that this gets caught up in a longstanding tension that the West has always had with Asia, embodied in the idea of Orientalism, where at the same time the West or Europeans wanted to view Asians as inferior because they were not white, but also couldn't find a way to negate, the very real cultural achievements and advancements that predated Western civilization. And so there's this weird tension in terms of both idealizing and at the same time trying to subjugate the idea of Asian in the United States. And when we ask that question, it does the same thing. It embodies the idea, well, somehow they are more advanced, whatever that means in quotes. But then at the same time, the very question, as you imply, is meant to subjugate, to divide, to invisibilize, and also to racialize them, to take away a sense of humanity. And so all of this swirls around, and it's really it's a very thorny, difficult issue.
You know, so what I was thinking is, as the other two guys were speaking, and I'm curious what our listeners think, at 410-319-8888, because we want to delve a little bit into the complexities between racial groups in America around Asian communities. But, you know, When communities like the Korean community and the Chinese community in America, communities in America, are labeled model minorities, what's the effect on those communities? What's the internal dialogue around that? Sui?
Oh, I'm sorry. Can you repeat the question?
Sure.
I am the spaciest person you'll ever meet.
That's
like,
cool.
I'm a creative writer, if you didn't know.
I do know.
It's lovely, but I'm often my fantasy world.
It's fine.
I'm so sorry. This is so inappropriate.
So what I'm saying is when like don't be. It's cool. When because I spaced out a lot this morning, so I'm having one of those days myself. When Chinese and Korean communities are often labeled the model communities that should be looked to by every other minority in America, looked to by Americans in general. And I'm curious what effect you think that has on Korean and Chinese families, Korean and Chinese sensibilities, the thinking inside the communities themselves.
Oh, gosh. Well, I think it's really troubling, honestly, and I don't blame my parents, because I think especially first-generation immigrants, there wasn't a lot of choice. Sometimes you had to kind of pull yourself up by your bootstraps if you could to move ahead and to survive. And I think that for my family, because now we live in like a middle-class urban house, I think it's really easy to believe that hard work gets you somewhere and that culture can somehow create discipline, which is really the logic behind justifying racism, right? Like, these structural barriers aren't that bad because some of us have overcome them on an individual level. And it's like a daily conversation, I think, right? Like, especially with my community and people I go to church with and my parents, it's like we have to believe that, like, us achieving a middle-class lifestyle would have done nothing to end global oppression or to end racism. In fact, it just kind of, like, changes the optics of it and makes us believe that America is progressive. But I know growing up, it was really difficult for me because I had a lot of trouble in school, so I have like a really severe anxiety disorder, and I still do. And I think that for especially like my Korean piano teacher, for my Korean parents, for the people that I went to church with, it was always like, why can't you just get over it? Like, this is in your mind. This is a choice. And that was really harmful to me because I felt like it just created more anxiety. And I definitely wasn't like the best in school. And in comparison, my sister was. And, you know, and it's nothing against her, but it just goes to show that a lot of people start thinking, like, especially my teachers would say, well, your sister did well, so you must not be trying hard enough. Whereas I feel like that doesn't happen to, like, your average, like, white, like, Joe Smith family.
So, you know, and I was thinking that a lot of this is really being, when you combine something like the Pew Charitable Trust study, we had these broad brush strokes about the Asian American community instead of communities, and you couple that with the American conscience being deeply affected by that kind of thinking and the thinking perpetrated in some ways by Amy Chua as Tiger Mom.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, those are the things. I mean, they said this is not a minor detail because this is deep in the American psyche. You know, about in today's world. So it's not something that's just kind of a lighthearted, you know, light. It's very deep seen. I think that in terms of the perception of all American communities about Asian communities, which that means to them, you have either Indian, Chinese, or Korean.
But for me, one of the things to note just interestingly is that to the degree that there are individuals in any community that gravitate towards the idea that they're separate from anyone else or separate from other communities is the degree to which they're still operating in a racial paradigm, right? Because if the country really was racially free and there weren't structural or economic barriers to success for everyone, there wouldn't be a need for you to try to distinguish yourself from other people. And that the need to try to do that is actually a recognition on some level that racism for everyone in America is at work. And I think that that's just an interesting idea, that it's not a way to actually escape. It actually is degree to which you embrace it is flows out of the racism that you know exists and perhaps even experienced.
That's really important. Sina?
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree with that. And I think, as Sui said, the pressure within Asian American families is extremely intense. And you see a lot of studies looking at mental health of Asian Americans who are reaching for or pushing against, but grappling with in some way this narrative, this stereotype. And just listening to Amara talk, I just thought Amy Chua's new book, The Triple Package, came to mind.
Uh-huh.
And it's exactly, you know, falling into the same ideological realm that we're talking about, because you know, she's using cultural explanations to explain structural inequalities. So, yeah, I think that it's a very important, and it has a very severe consequences for the Asian American community itself, and that's something that we need to look at within our communities and families and heal from, and also try to understand what political purposes the narrative serves for the work that we do within our community.
So let me open the phones again here, and then I'll come back to where you all just left off at 410-319-8888. Eric, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. How y'all doing?
Very well.
So I guess I have a comment and a question.
Sure.
My comment is I guess, you know, we've been knocking the stereotype, you know, that Asian folks are super high performing and super intelligent. You know, absolutely. I absolutely agree that stereotypes can be viciously poisonous in a society. At the same time, in my experience, you know, growing up as a classical pianist, 9/10 of the time, it was an Asian kid that beat me. So, you know, there's also, you know, same with ping pong, same with, you know, math class, you know, so there are really awesomely, you know, high performing Asian folks. And I'm not saying the generalization should be perpetuated, but there's, you know, there's some truth there.
So that I'm okay, Eric, let's wrestle with that a minute. I mean, cause I think that, you know, where's this line between mythology and reality?
So, I think that's a spectacular question. There's no myth without some truth to it, right?
So hold on one second. Let me just see what our guests are thinking about that. I think what you raised is really interesting. You want to wrestle with that first, Amara, then we'll go through our guests?
I mean, I think that there are threads of truth in every myth, but a thread, you know, doesn't create a department store full of clothes. It's one thread. And the truth is that there are a lot of institutional factors. One of the things about being an economist is that you look at institutional factors, that if there are a group of people who are overperforming or a group of people that are underperforming, it's not because there's a fundamental difference in human beings. It's a fundamental difference in the structures and the institutions in which they operate. So let's take what was just said. So, okay, perhaps, you know, there was a person of Chinese descent, let's say, who outperformed in a math class, but that person very well could have been the child of people who immigrated to the United States, as was outlined before, based upon selective immigration in the sciences and in math. And so what you actually see is the child of people who are predisposed and who pushed and cultivated and developed a person who then shows up and looks as if they are somehow, you know, a part of a superclass when there's an institutional reason for that. We could you know, pull model minority for anything. We could say, well, you know, let's just look at all, you know, blacks who graduated from Ivy League schools, and that could be a model minority. You know, it's there are institutional reasons why people perform and underperform.
So we're going to take a short break. I'm going to come back and ask our other two guests to wrestle with this and go back to the phones and Connie in Baltimore, the next caller up, and look at other issues that go deeper into this wide group of people who we call Asian Americans. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Back with Diana Ross and Supremes again, because it's Diana Ross's birthday, born on this day in 1944. We are here. We've just heard Amara Jones, who wrote the article that got this conversation started today, The Economic Truth About the Model Minority, where he is economic justice contributor at colorlines.com. And we are also joined by Sui Park, who's a writer, activist based in Chicago, creator of Not Your Asian Sidekick hashtag on Twitter, and Sina Huang Jensen, who is a member of the Baltimore Racial Justice Action Project, ACTION, which is a project of Fusion Partnerships, a graduate student at the University of Maryland College Park studying Asian American history, and a member of the Moonroot Collective, and you at 410-319-8888. Before we go to Connie's call, so I was thinking as this other caller called in and what Amara was saying, Sina, that what you and Sui both talked about, which I'm in kind of exploring in more depth, the notion of mythology and reality, which is the pressure you said you felt inside the community, inside your own home. I'm kind of exploring here this mythology and reality of what this model minority means.
Absolutely, yeah. I think there is an intense pressure within the model minority too,
internalized,
other
right.
racial and internalized pressure. And there's other internalization of racism, you know, for all communities of color and including whites.
Right.
I think that is a very important aspect that we need to focus on. But in response to the caller, I think the real thing we really need to focus on is distinguishing cultural explanations from structural explanations.
Uh-huh.
So if you see 9 out of 10, I think they said, times, you know, a Chinese American is winning the piano competition, for example. Instead of using cultural explanations to explain that, well, they're naturally good at the piano. I mean, we're talking about billions of people. But, you know, if you want to think that way, or they're just naturally inclined to do certain things, look at the structure, because very few people actually know the Asian American history, the actual history of how our communities were formed and have survived in this country. And so I would say the first thing is to really debunk culture. I think of when people think about Chinatown, a lot of times, you know, people will say, oh, Chinatown's emerged because, you know, Chinese people, they really like to stick together. You know, they're exclusive. And so, you know, but when you look at the history, you see that Chinatowns emerged because of racial segregation. You know, so it's really important to not rely solely on cultural explanations. When you see these things that are realities, start to ask yourself, what are the structures in place that made this a reality?
That's a really important point. Sue, you want to follow up on that before we go back to the phones?
Yeah, on that point in particular?
Yeah, on whatever point grabbed you from what you heard.
Well, I was just wondering, was the caller Eric, is he white?
I have no idea.
Okay, he sounds white to me.
Okay, maybe. He may have been, but I have no idea. I can't see through the radio.
Yeah, totally. I was just curious if that would inform
right,
his mystified
right.
opinion. Yeah, I mean, like, I think that I actually saw a lot of Asian Americans kind of clinging to Amy Tua and her new book, which is kind of disheartening. I saw a lot of people using the Not Your Asian Sidekick hashtag, which we used to communicate and advocate to promote her new book. And I saw one person after Not Your Asian Sidekick got big use Amy's picture in one of the articles to say, like, no, we're not your Asian sidekick. And then it was like, damn, this is Amy Tua. And she's like a go-getter, and she's a pioneer for Asian American women. Which I really hated the idea of, because I think that, like, it is super convenient for these institutions to adapt to critique. And, like, at the end of the day, it's all about profit. And so if Amy Tua is going to go there as, like, the token Asian sidekick and go and say that, like, it's not that bad and that our culture enables us to be successful, then they already have a spokesperson who's going up and saying these things to represent a group of people who, you know, she doesn't actually understand. So I think that's also the danger.
So let me go to the phones here. Now. I'm sorry. I'm going to go back to the phones here and get another caller in and then raise another issue that Imara raised in this article, which I think is really critical, at 410-319-8888. Connie, you're on the air.
Hi. I just have a quick comment. When I was in the ninth grade, first day of school, my teacher took the roll and looked at me and said, oh, you're Tom Hearn's sister. And I was unable to accomplish anything in her class and wound up dropping out of the ninth grade and going to college and was an A student. But I think that kids live up to what's expected of them. And that's I think, the main factor.
Thank you so much. Any thoughts on what Connie was saying? Imara or Sina?
Yeah, I think this is Sina. I think that that is a really good point, and it goes back to what we're talking about when we talk about the pressure within and internally and externally. Asian American children, there is an expectation. If you look at popular media, if you look at popular attitudes towards Asians, there is a definite expectation that you will be this certain thing. And so when you grow up with that pressure, you have, you know, very constricted options. Do you embrace it? Do you reject it? Do you do both? Is it contrary? But you have to grapple with this internally, and it's a struggle. And I think that can be applied, that same kind of principle can be applied to other children too, the stereotypes that we apply to them.
No. And what's interesting about it is that it's meant to not to be an anti-racial stereotype, right? But what it actually is a racial stereotype, because you're ultimately confined by it, and then whatever else is a part of your humanity gets lost.
Exactly. And I think that, and I want to raise this piece that you also raised in your article, which I think is important to look at, and because I've been looking up a lot of kind of statistical information that really is important. We talk about this when people kind of make this broad brush stroke about Asian Americans. You know, because when you look at people who come from Cambodia, who were refugees, the Hmong people, many of the Vietnamese refugees, the numbers are very different, and they reflect the kind of repression that people came out of, and who came here, and why, and
that's
when. You know?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, that applies to what we were talking about earlier. You know, along the lines of selective immigration, people who came from Southeast Asia. It was in the wake of a war, and there was no ability to be able to say, oh, well, do you have this or that, and in terms of education. And even to this day, the leading country of origin for education visas is China. And so that means that disproportionately people who are from China who immigrate to the United States right now and who attend school here are people who are highly educated. And so what their life chances are and what their education levels are going to be very different for someone who is a refugee from Afghanistan or from Pakistan or from Cambodia. And all of these numbers are different. Even amongst South Asians, there's a tremendous amount of variability. So Bangladeshis don't have the same income picture as Indians, nor Sri Lankans. And the problem is that, as I said before, in order for this idea of model minority to actually work, it has to be so specific and so segmented that it ends up losing a lot of what is actually the truth, and so doesn't have a lot of meaning.
Sina?
Yeah. Did you say Sina or Sui? Sorry.
I said Sina, but either one can jump in. Go ahead, Sina.
This is Sina. Go ahead. I think that's absolutely true, and I think that when you look at, we're looking at such a small, it's just fascinating because it's the root of this is just so absurd, the racialized thinking, you know, mm-hmm. that goes into looking at an entire population through the lens of, you know, groups that immigrate to the United States. It really needs to be unpacked, and I think, I also think about the way that Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders are grouped together in the statistics and the invisibility right. that a lot of Pacific Islanders face, you know, Native Hawaiians, those from Guam, Samoa, American Samoa. So it's really, really important to disaggregate this data, and it's not just about being accurate. It is about humanity, as Amara's pointed out.
I mean, one of the things I think and hope here is this whole question, you know, of how we, when you talk about aggregated data, Sina, I was thinking, Sui, that, you know, you look at things like the Pew study, and that is the danger. I mean, we really have to think about who we are as Americans, where we come from our individual cultures, to understand who we are and how we all fit together in this new America being created. There's a very multiracial America, because I think we really have to kind of stand up and get away from these kind of broad brush strokes of talking about Asian Americans.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that.
So, I mean, how do we wrestle with that? How do we get to that? I mean, what do we have to wrestle with here to kind of really expand the consciousness of what we're talking about in our country?
I don't know. That's a really big question. I think in general, we need to reject the idea of multiculturalism. I feel like, especially in universities, there's this idea, like, we need to move past the black-white binary, and that representation is kind of the end goal of what we're looking for, when that's definitely not true. Those are kind of surface-level solutions to much larger problems. So I think especially when places group Asian Americans together as one homogenous group, it looks like we might do okay, right? Like when people publish reports and it says like 10% of Asian Americans are in our universities are doing well. But if they don't disaggregate that data, then what's happening is that the most privileged within our communities are continuing to kind of cover up the inequities at the bottom. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. I'm curious your take on that, Sina.
Sure. About how we can address the model minority stereotype.
I think that really kind of raises maybe a larger issue we have time for to wrestle with today. But I think that this is, I mean, this is such a critical issue. I really want to invite you all back to take a larger look at this. Just looking at what the future of America looks like and how we have to begin to redefine how we even approach ourselves, our communities, and the larger community and what we're building here.
Right. So I think, you've identified, you know, different levels that we need to operate on within our communities, between our communities, and as a nation. And I really agree with what Sui said, that we need to counter the multiculturalism that and the colorblind racism that mm-hmm. is at the heart of our discussions about racism and also at the heart of these kinds of statistics and arguments.
So, I'm only breaking this. We have to take a break here, and I want to thank all of you for being part of this program. This has been a great discussion. You guys are amazing. Sina Wong Jensen, thank you so much for being with us. Look forward to having you back with us again very soon. And Imara Jones, you always write some stuff that makes us think and brings us these conversations, and I really appreciate the work you do. Thank you so much for being
with
us once again today. And Sui Park, great to meet you and have you on the show with us. Look forward to following your writing and work. Thank you all so much. We're going to take a short break and come right back. Don't go away.